This meeting is now being recorded.
All right, good morning all. Initially, let me start off with an obvious apology for being late. Those of you that know me, I typically am early in the meetings. I was here about 9:15 and made a going to Starbucks to get a cup of coffee, and my car is now dead as a doornail. So Rebecca Fleming came to my rescue. The car is, well, somebody can tow it away. But anyways, I apologize for starting late. I appreciate everybody being here. We have a full, relatively full agenda today. I thought such a full agenda that a phone meeting was not appropriate, but I also have optimism that, as typically given the efficiency of this group, that we can work through this agenda by 2 o'clock, if not well before 2 o'clock. I know at times it can be a little frustrating for significant travel if the agenda ends too early, but better too early than too late. So with that, I do want to acknowledge a few things. Jeff Lewis of King's is out retired and therefore is obviously not in the room, not on the committee. He was last with us at the FMS meeting we had just a few weeks ago, and we acknowledged his contribution to both the funding methodology subcommittee and this committee as well over the years, and thanked him for all that work. I'm confident that Jeff is today because he's actually no longer employed by the courts. Also, the past presiding judge of the Fresno County Superior Court, Kim Gabe, has now been appointed as a liaison through CGER governing committee to tick back and intended to cover today's meeting, but we're going through some personnel issues today that as past presiding judge she has to be involved in, so she was not able to for those purposes. Additionally, TCP Jack has also appointed a liaison to this committee who's on the committee, Judge Blum. There you go. Thanks. I'm just starting to get oriented. Who's here as well on this committee and also the liaison for TCP Jack, so we appreciate that very much. And you here and there. And now I think it's time to take roll.
Judge Conklin.
I am finally here.
Judge Clayton is here. Judge Blum. Jeff Lee.
Here.
Judge Cope.
Here.
Judge Herman.
Here.
Judge Henrich.
Here.
Judge Lucas.
Here.
Judge Marginis.
Here.
Judge Maragonda.
Here.
Judge McCabe.
I talked to Judge McCabe yesterday. He said he would be attending telephonically, but he was also in a trial.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Carter?
Here.
Ms. Eberhardt? Mr. Pinky?
Ms. Fleming?
She's here because she just rescued me.
Ms. Flinner?
Here.
Mr. Harrigan?
Here.
Mr. Planet?
Here.
Mr. Roddy?
Here.
Ms. Marisol?
Here.
Mr. Taylor?
Here.
Ms. Ugrin Capobianco?
Here, with apologies that I could not attend in person.
Thank you. Mr. Yamasaki?
Here.
Mr. Wardlaw? And Mr. Theodorovich will be joining us soon.
Okay. I'm told, let's see here, to the next thing on the agenda is to remind you all to place your phones on mute, which I'm sure you've all done if you are calling in, but I'm sorry, don't place on hold, only on mute. I don't hear any hold music, so I think you're all used to that by now. So our first procedural item, I will ask for anybody who has previously reviewed the minutes of our last meeting, February 15th, for a motion to approve those minutes.
So moved.
All right.
Second.
Moved and seconded to approve the minutes of the February 15th tickback meeting. Is there any opposition to approving the minutes of that telephonic meeting? Hearing no opposition, the minutes are deemed approved. Moving now to public comment, do we have any written public comment?
No.
We did not receive any written public comment, and I don't believe, is there anybody signed up? There's nobody as well signed up for public comment in the room, so while we always welcome public comment, there is none today. So we will move right into our first agenda item, which is the workload-based allocation WAFM adjustment request. I'm going to introduce Steph on this. James is right there, and James is going to take care of this from the beginning. It is an action item for us today. James?
Good morning, everybody. In July of last year, the original adjustment request process was amended. What you have in your packet is the amended without the changes. So a clean copy, the one in the previous packet from July of last year, had the old with the other, with the edits to it. This is a clean copy of the new adjustment request procedures with no changes, just taking the edits out for clarity. The new process is very similar to the old process that requires you to get any requests in by January 15th, and then it comes to this body, and our request at this time is to send it to FMS for review to be added to the work plan. There are currently two items, two request processes that were sent to us by that January 15th deadline, one from Del Norte and one from Stanislaus. I don't want to give them short shrift, but essentially the Del Norte process is asked to reevaluate how Waltham affects small courts, and asking to look if there is any unique waiting scenarios or any other things that need to be done to better handle the small courts. And Stanislaus has a quick review of OE&E, what's included in OE&E, specifically looking at court-funded leases and rents. Again, that's just a quick sketch. The full version is in your packet, and the request and the ask is to send it to FMS for review to be added to our work plan for the next fiscal year.
So I welcome discussion on this topic. Obviously, as you're all aware, and there's some FMS members, including the co-chair with me, Rebecca Fleming, who are working methodically and, in my opinion, diligently through this issue. So this is the adjustment request process to WAFM that's now a written process. We are going through these, and we'll continue to go through these with our FMS meetings as we work through now the scheduled process. James, I want to be real careful the way I look at this, but it strikes me, and this is going to go to FMS, so we're not anything here besides simply approving the adjustment request procedures, but I want to make sure that these adjustment request procedures are directed towards adjustments to the WAFM process itself, not to an individual court's request to adjust their funding based on WAFM. Is that correct?
Correct. This
okay.
is in our efforts to continually review WAFM as approved this year by the Judicial Council to make sure that we are continuously reviewing best ways to change it if necessary as this body at FMSC fits.
Okay. So that's all I was trying to clarify was this is intended just for that purpose rather than, and if, I'm not trying to say that if a court has a concern about its funding through WAFM, that there's not other outlets through which it can voice that concern, but this is not that. This is to address the WAFM procedure itself as it applies to all of the trial courts throughout the state. So with that, opening it up to any discussion on this item.
So are we being asked to just approve the referral to the funding methodology?
Essentially.
Yeah, I think that that's what the policy requires us to do, and so I would move that we refer to the funding methodology to review.
All right.
Second that.
All right, moved and seconded. It essentially, and I hope I'm not simplifying this, but we comply with the procedure. The
yes.
procedure is the requests come in just like they should have. It now goes down to FMS. FMS looks at it, takes action, and then refers it back up to tick back to ultimately go to the council if there's a suggestion that will often be modified. It's been moved and seconded that the two submissions pursuant to the adjustment request procedures be referred back down to FMS for consideration and appropriate action by FMS. Any discussion on the motion that has been seconded? Hearing no discussion and following prior procedures, any opposition in the room to the motion that has been moved and seconded? Hearing no opposition, I'm therefore going to deem the motion unanimously approved by this TICBAC committee to refer back down to FMS for consideration as we've discussed.
You said in the room, and I think there are members on the phone.
You're right. So Judge Cope has pointed out that we have members on the phone, so let me pause for a moment. Are there any members on the phone, TICBAC members, who would like to either make comments or have objection to the motion? And I've waited, I've paused, I've heard nothing, so I'm going to reaffirm my previous affirmation that the motion has been approved unanimously. All right. So we're now going to move to item two on the agenda, which takes us to the minimum operating and emergency reserve policy. Again, this is an action item, and Brandy Sanborn, sitting to my left, is from Budget Services, is here to present this to us. Brandy?
The minimum operating and emergency fund balance section of the fund balance policy that begins at page 17 requires courts to maintain a fund balance or reserve of approximately 3 to 5% of their prior year general fund expenditures. This requirement has been suspended since 2012, with the most recent suspension expiring at the end of this fiscal year. To To provide some history, in August 2012, the Council first suspended the minimum operating and emergency fund balance policy for 2 years due to, one, the establishment of the 2% reserve in the Trial Court Trust Fund, or CCTF, that began in fiscal year 12-13, in which each court contributed from its base allocation for operations, and two, Government Code 77203, that put a 1% cap on fund balance that courts can carry forward, effective June 30, 2014. So instead of eliminating the policy, the two fiscal year suspension was applied in recognition of efforts to either eliminate or increase the 1% cap. In October 2014, the Council approved another two fiscal year suspension on the policy to provide additional time to repeal the 1% cap or increase the amount of the 1% cap. Moving to April 2016, the Council adopted CCTF funds held on behalf process, allowing courts to request funds be retained in the TCTF as restricted fund balance to benefit courts that have expenditures that cannot be funded by a court's annual budget or three-year encumbrance term and that require multi-year savings to implement. Then a little later, July 2016, the 2% reserve requirement was replaced with a new reserve policy for trial courts by providing $10 million one-time general fund as a reserve in the TCTF for emergency purposes. So finally, in January 2017, the Council extended the suspension again for two fiscal years, or earlier if the government code placing the 1% cap was repealed or amended, while in the interim continuing advocacy for repeal. So efforts to both repeal Government Code 77203 and increase the 1% cap amount have occurred with the Department of Finance and the legislature. As it is planned to continue these efforts with the new administration, it is recommended that the suspension of the minimum operating and emergency fund balance policy be extended two fiscal years until June 30, 2020, or sooner if Government Code Section 77203 is repealed or amended. That concludes my report.
Moving right along. Questions, concerns, Mr. Yamasaki?
No questions. I just wanted to... extension.
Okay. Been moved that the ongoing extension continue to be extended. Ms. Renner?
Second.
Moved and seconded. Again, moving through this agenda at a rapid clip. So and by the way, Mr. Finke's come in. We took roll chats here now. Any discussion about this? And any comments, any concerns? I think we're all recognize this is an important issue and something we hope is ultimately resolved, but that goes beyond, I think, the both assignment and authority of this subcommittee, this advisory subcommittee, to do. We do have FPS, which considers requests from courts. We're going to have a meeting at the end of this meeting today to consider ongoing requests. So I remind, as Brandy said, there's a mechanism that courts can come forward with, trial courts, and come forward and say for their reserve that they want to roll over, so to speak, that money. It stays in the Trial Court Trust Fund, but they have access to that for ongoing expenditures or projects. And we have some of those. I think we're going to consider six or seven of those this afternoon. So from that perspective, again, just to sort of, if anything else, just use up time, FPS is working very well. FPS considers, and that mechanism, I think, is very vibrant. So until the 1% and the 2% are otherwise changed, we have tools that we can allow give some courts relief as far as the 1% and expenditures that they may need to keep in reserve for those tasks. Moved and seconded that the concurrent extensions be extended. Is there a specific extended, would you say 2 years?
2 years to June 30, 2020.
So it's 2020 the extension will go, so hopefully by then, rather than kicking the can down the road again, we'll have something else in place for any of us that are still in the room then. Any discussion? All right. Moved and seconded that the extension be continued to June of 2020. Any opposition either in the room or from those TICFAC members that are calling in on the phone? Pause and waited. There appears to be no opposition, so I will deem, as far as item two goes, that is unanimously approved by this subcommittee as well. Now moving to item three, which will be Don. As I saw Don, here he is, and this is the juvenile dependency proposed allocation for the 2017-2018 Dependency Council Collections Program. And Don, feel free to speak as slow as you'd like.
This report contains three recommendations for you. The first recommendation is the allocation of the funding that is collected by court for from parents and juvenile dependency counsel who can afford to pay for their part of their counseling collected every year. By statute, we then reallocate it to courts who are in who need for dependency counsel funding is in excess of the amount of dependency counsel funding they receive. This year, there's $542,000 to reallocate. Our table, attachment 3A, shows how we recommend reallocating. It's in the same, using the same methodology we've used for the past several years.
And that's, is that the table on page 28?
Page 28, yes.
Okay.
The second recommendation is also standing item. In this recommendation, we staff went out in the early part of this year to court, checking whether their spending of their dependency counsel allocation might leave savings on the table. We contacted those courts where it looked like by spending pattern they may understand that we had. Several courts confirmed that they would underspend this year and that funding could be released for reallocation. The total of that was $679,000 that we identified. And we distributed in the same way that we distributed the dependency collection funding to courts whose need is basically below the median of what's provided to all courts. So that table attachment 3B shows our recommended reallocation of that funding. We also reallocate that funding in proportion to the total amount of unmet need for the courts that are eligible to have the funding reallocated. The final recommendation is new and generated by staff to kind of clarify a point that was left unclear in the last recommendations about small court funding exceptions, which the council approved last May. In those exceptions, the council established continue to use a $100,000 funding reserve for small courts that might be experiencing short-term filing increases or bounces in a single year, because that's one of the, as opposed to larger courts that can absorb increases, small courts can see their total caseload go up by 50% almost overnight. So the council established a fund of $100,000. Last year, we distributed most of that fund to small courts that were experiencing caseload spikes. This year, we calculate the need for small courts experiencing caseload spikes to be $250,000. That's on attachment 3C, where we show the average funding that small court, or the average caseload of small court, the spikes over 10%, and what that average is out to. There was discussion during the small court working group for dependency counsel and the committees that preceded it as to what would happen if we expanded the reserve and there was still, or if the need for funding was greater than $100,000 in a single year. As I say, last year it was not. It was under $100,000. So we wanted to bring that back to the committee and say, by population, the need is more than 100,000. We ask you to consider, or I should say several people here were at all of those committee meetings, so we'll may want to weigh in, but it was my impression during those discussions that we did talk about should we replenish the year, but then never came to a, or replenish the reserve if 100,000 was not enough, but never came to a conclusion. So we put that on the table as recommendation number three. It would be possible to net out of the reallocated recommendation. Recommendation for reallocation is 2A of 679,000, the additional 150,000. And attachment 3B, the final two columns show that what it is to reallocate the full reallocation of 679,000, the full amount we expect to be unspent, and what the reallocation would be if that was netted out to reserve 150 more for small claims. And then the next table, the last one, attachment 3C, shows in the down at the last column L, where it says prorated to 66% of need, that shows the what we calculate as the need driven by caseload spikes this year, most in two counties. So that concludes my summary of this report.
Carter.
So I will take the first two and say that one of the challenges of the judicial committee, you know, like the Trump Open Advisory Committee, is there's these long histories with deep dive data and work that new members then come in and don't realize has occurred. And so I know from personal experience in working on the Dependency Council committee that the first two recommendations on trying to bring the funding to an equitable level based on need, and I strongly support the first two recommendations. They were, after painful meetings, public comments that involved court input, it took over a year and a half to develop them. They've been approved by the council, and so I would strongly support and recommend recommendation one and two, because like so many other things we inherited, funding inequities that we're now trying to fix, and this is doing it slowly through the reallocation of money. So I would move that we approve one and two. It is the council's policy. Nothing has changed, and it's based on a lot of work and pain that involved a lot of organizations. So that would be my motion, and then I can stop when it gets to the third recommendation.
You have concerns about, we won't go there yet, but are there comments you want to make about the third recommendation?
The third recommendation is harder for me because there are many courts that I know of that pay for dependency counsel funding out of their limited budget, too, and I'm thinking of one in particular on my side of the table that does that. And so I know that it's a challenge with small courts, but it's also a challenge for underfunded courts. And so my heart is always with the small courts. I'm curious what percentage of their total they would pay at the $100,000 level compared to the underfunded courts, because we're not to next year yet where there's an average funding line. So they're still having to grasp dealing with their nature being underfunded, and what percentage they're paying for their dependency counsel, because whether you're small or big, if you don't have the money, you're making hard choices. So it's harder for me because I don't know if I have enough information. I don't know if I'm articulating that very well. Don's shaking his head yes. But so small courts on average are paying 7%, but we have underfunded
I ask is because, as you've seen on other budget where we have numerous recommendations, they play together. And if you're comfortable that 1 and 2 are somewhat separate from 3, then we can just consider 1 and 2 and then move to 3, as long as you're not concerned that if we change 3, it's then going to have to have us look back at 1 and 2.
But
right.
I don't know if we have enough. I mean, do we know the actual amount that we're going to need this fiscal year for 3, Don? Do we know it's going to be 250, or is that an estimate based on...
It's an estimate. Yeah, we don't know.
And don't we have some reserve that carries over?
No.
Okay. So I have a question. Do we know which courts are still paying out-of-pocket to pay for dependency counsel? Because that's, I think, part that factors in.
No, we know the courts do, but we don't collect which ones do.
Well, budget couldn't do that, because when I was on the committee, I actually pulled the statewide data. It's just a lot of work, and I'm not volunteering to do it again, because I'm no longer on the committee. But you can't, budget can do it, because you put it in a certain accounting code.
Judge Cole?
I was also on that committee, and one of the chairs of the committee, there was a lot of work, a lot of discussion, a lot of, like with everything with budget, a lot of compromise, and the parts that all fit together, and I agree, and so I'll second motion as to 1 and 2. I don't have a position at this point as to 3, though.
Okay, so now we have the motion for to approve 1 and 2 before we move to 3, though we started to discuss 3, but there's no motion on 3 yet. Everybody's comfortable.
Can I ask a question,
sure.
Donald? By proving 1 and 2, we've killed 3. Because wouldn't the difference of $150,000 come from 2?
Yes.
Okay. So I think we need to... I'm following this because I know I've been buried in these details, so...
So in legal terms, if we approve 1 and 2, we move 3, right?
And there's no other way to fund it, but we don't know if it's really 150 or if it's 75, right, Don? I mean, we don't know what the amount is they need.
Randy and I were just going through it. So I think there's another piece that might be useful for the discussion. The Small Court Working Group presented recommendations to the council in May, which included this reserve at $100,000. Those recommendations were for 2 years. So they are for this year and for next year, after which they expire. And I think also Brandy and I wanted to bring to your attention that this group will probably want to think about what to do about those expires. There are exemptions for, I'm sorry, I keep talking like everyone has followed this intently for years and years. last year, that working group put in, recommended to the council that essentially small courts be exempted from the reductions that other courts were taking in dependency counsel, that we adjust some underlying figures to bring them a bit more money, but that only lasts for 2 years. And then it's unclear what the next step is, except that they expire and everyone reverts to what will be just average state level funds.
But they expire at the end of next year.
They expire at the end
right.
of next year. So we wanted to also put on the table that we have this coming year left to talk about small courts again if we want to make changes to that. So that might be helpful in discussing the recommendation 3.
If a small hit with a ton of filings and they needed money, would there be any place that they could go if the 100,000 isn't enough? Could, I know we've got the extraordinary homicide account, but this isn't falling into that category. But, you know, I understand their problem because you can't control the filing.
Well, so it seemed to me, Sherry, at a minimum they could go to the $10 million reserve.
Oh, yeah, good
right.
point. Yeah, okay, well, then I support 1 and 2. I go back to 1 and 2.
So, again, there would be an alternative or at least some relief available to them if we didn't take action on 3.
Right. So then I do continue with my motion on 1 and 2.
Okay, so it's been moved and seconded, 1 and 2 be approved. The only reason I was hesitating to take a final vote on that is a concern that by doing that, we're either going to moot three, or if we do something different on three, we're going to change one and two. But if you're both comfortable that we can move forward on one and two and then make a decision on three, that's fine. Any concerns about that? So that's, I'm sorry.
Just so I'm clear, that I was on that committee as well, small court dependency working group. And so that was an approval of up to an amount. Am I correct about that, to the $150,000? And now this is an ask of an additional $100,000 to be distributed?
That approved $100,000, and this is, yes, this is an ask of an additional $150,000 to that reserve.
I'm just wondering if it was, I don't remember as part of that group, if it was, this is a hard and fast extra amount that we're going to leave in reserve, and after that, too bad, so sad, or if it's, here's an estimate, and but the intent is to make everybody whole.
We weren't clear either.
Okay.
And so
well, the good news, Kevin, is Mike, I hate to say we tried again because I just hated having that in public meetings, but we have that $10 million emergency bill.
Right.
So if something really happened, they could apply and get money there.
Understood.
Over the $100,000.
Is there a comment on the phone? Never mind. Okay.
Well, and I think the beauty of that, is that anybody could apply.
Sure.
I mean, not just small court with regards to it.
Yep.
Right. It's obviously there's that $10 million is not without restrictions, so to speak. So they would have to establish what they qualify, how they qualify for that, but that doesn't mean they can't ask.
Yep.
Right.
And, but the other piece as far as ongoing information, I think it is important to have who's paying how much out of general funds as far as the informational in dealing with those, even though it may be hard to get to have further discussions if we do in the future.
One other question on the $10 million that they would potentially be able to ask for. That, and there aren't any timelines that have passed that would prevent them from doing that at this point. I'm not lucky enough to not have to know those deadlines.
There are deadlines for them to get an actual allocation increase. After, I'm trying to remember, we have to have the input by the April council or May council meeting. Otherwise, then it's done as a cash advance,
right,
and then they review the application in the subsequent year.
I just want to make sure that is still an option.
Right, yeah.
I mean,
there's no deadline for the ask. It's how we allocate the funding, whether it's an increase, as you said, or a loan, and then they would ask the following year. But otherwise, it's open.
And remember that the way the $10 million, I'm just telling you all something you probably already know, the way the $10 million functions is if it's awarded, so to speak, then all the courts contribute back in to bring it up to $10 million. So every year, that fund floats at $10 million, and if it comes down below 10 for very valid reasons, then all the trial courts in an appropriate share bring it back up to 10 for the next year. So we would all share in that expenditure.
A question for Don. If it goes over the $100,000, how is it determined who got the first $100,000 or who's short?
That question makes sense. Well, we would do it pro rata across the need. We would allocate the $100,000 pro rata.
Because the need is mostly two counties.
Yeah.
You pointed out.
But no, yeah. So people would not go short just because they haven't asked for it. So.
Any other thoughts? So the current, it's been moved and seconded that recommendations one and two be approved. And I'm opening up a final discussion or comment on one and two. Any opposition to recommendations one and two being approved by this advisory committee? Anybody on the phone who has a comment of one and two or is in opposition to recommendations one and two that I set out at page 24, I believe, to be approved? Hearing none, I'll deem one and two approved unanimously. Now, so Don, what does that do to three?
Well, that ends three. We can, as staff, communicate to courts that they can apply through the reserve process, and then we line out three.
Okay, so I wanted, again, for both procedural purposes and clarification, make sure we actually are taking action on three. One and two have essentially not to get legal about it, but mooted 3. So we will not take any action on 3 because 3 is no longer a recommendation based upon our actions on 1 and 2. Sherry?
Agree, but I do, can you outline then what, how we're going to join these two groups? Because I do think small courts have legitimate issues, both finding, retaining, and paying, you know, that we spent a lot of time a few years ago looking at it. So how are we going to merge that together if it does expire at the end of next fiscal year?
That would go FMS first.
Okay.
Would look at it, make a recommendation to that.
So is this, so Rebecca and I, pardon me, right, we're talking as we, as we know it's coming up, so I don't want to kick this can down the road. I would, I guess this advisory committee could make a request of the subcommittee of FMS that staff come back to FMS with the information that you suggested and that FMS then consider adding it to the work plan. I'm trying to figure out how we can,
I think it would have to be referred to that subcommittee for discussion.
I think I heard you say that, didn't you,
Kevin,
that you were going to refer that on over?
I don't recall.
The FMS would be more than happy to take a look at it, right, Rebecca?
Because the goal is you don't want it to expire. We need to have a plan in place. Right.
I would agree.
Is the small part kind of people, or is that
dissolved?
Okay. Don, you understand what we've done and what we'll do?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. Anybody want to take a break? Okay. The next item on the agenda is adjustments to the council-approved 17-18 allocations from the State Trial Court IMF Fund. And this is another action item, and Donna is going to present on this. Good morning, Donna.
Good morning. Good morning. I bring to you item number 4 on the agenda, which is an adjustment to the already council-approved allocations from 2017-18 for the State Trial Court Improvement Modernization Fund. There are two offices looking to augment their budget. The first office is the Core Operations Services. For the language access plan and support, it is a net zero impact to the IMF fund, as the 2017-18 budget had one-time support in the amount of $352,000 for the video remote interpreting spoken language pilot program. General fund monies have already been transferred into the IMF and are designated for this purpose only. The second office that is seeking an augmentation is the is the IT program, information technology. It is specifically for the jury management program. The augmentation request is $340,000 in addition to the original $465,000 judicial council approved allocation. This would give them a total of $805,000. The funds for this program are mandated in statute under Government Code 772-09-H. And are to be used for this purpose only. There are excess funds available for this purpose. Again, not a zero impact to the IMF fund in total. At the so we are asking in total for augmentations a total of $692,000 to the IMF allocations from 2017-18. For your consideration.
And you say the net impact to the IMF is essentially zero.
Essentially zero.
I move to approve.
All right. Item. You move approve both recommendations?
Yes.
All right. I guess it's one recommendation of two funds. Right. So for a total amount of $692,000, which is comprised of the $352 plus the $340.
All right. Sir.
Okay, moved, approved, seconded twice. Any discussion on this item? Any opposition to the motion which has been seconded to approve? Hearing none, deemed approved. Moving right along. Item 5 is a revised reporting requirement for the TCTF, NIMF, and Donna is back up on this, and I'm going to go get a cup of water. Donna?
Thank you. So in prior kickback meetings, a recommendation was adopted for the Judicial Council staff to report semi-annually on open encumbrances for the Trial Court Trust Fund as well as the IMF Fund. Encumbrances were to report on June 30 and again through December 31. The report through December 31 is used as a tool in the planning process of the budget year allocations and the preparation of the fund condition statement. However, the June 30 report currently is not used by budget staff for anything at this point. So we would ask, our recommendation is, or our request is to reduce the number of reporting times to annually instead of semi-annually.
I stepped out of the room to get a glass of water and it's over. Thoughts, considerations on what appears to be the final action item on our agenda today? All right, it's been moved that this item be approved. The recommendation is specifically set forth on, I believe, page 36 of your material.
Seconded.
It's been seconded. Any further discussion on item 5 and the recommendation to be approved on page 36 of the material? Anybody on the phone have a comment or an opposition to this motion? Anybody in the room have an opposition to the motion? Hearing none, the final action item at 11 o'clock is deemed approved. So that gets us to discussion items. Considering where we are, let's take a brief break so we can just reorganize the discussion items, and then we'll come back and have the discussion items done probably prior to the time lunch arrives. So for those of you on the phone, we're going to take a break for about 10 minutes. So we're all on the same sheet of music. We'll start back up again at 11:15. All right, thank you. know, we're way ahead of the game, but we do have call-in folks. And I want to stay true to what we told them about getting started, so we're going to start back up again and go live on the recording.
Are we recording?
Yes.
Okay, we're recording. So thank you all for your efficiency in the first action items. We've resolved all of those action items, and while we're ahead of schedule, so we're going to move. All right, we're going to move to information items. I'm told as well that the lunch has arrived. So before I move to information items, I do want to take a moment and recognize Suzanne Blihovdi, who's in the room. And I was just – Suzanne has worked closely with many of us on various committees, including the Fiscal Planning Subcommittee that has a meeting right at the end of the day of this meeting today. She's been more than helpful, more than efficient, and is retiring as of tomorrow. So while I truly appreciate it being chair of TICBAC, people keep leaving, and I'm not sure what that says about me being chair. But, Suzanne, thank you very, very much for all you've done throughout the time, your efficient work. We probably know about this much of it compared to what you do every day for staff. So thank you so much for your efficient and valuable work. So we're now going to go to our information items. We're going to stay. We were going to change it around a little bit because LACO had some meetings to make, but we're so far ahead of time, I think we're going to stay true to the agenda, which gets us right to the information item regarding the current status of the AB 1058 subcommittee. And Judge Cope is here and has graciously agreed to present that.
Thanks. I don't think we'll extend the meeting by any time at all because it's just going to be a brief update on what's going on. For those who are fairly new to this committee, the issue is how to allocate funding that's allocated under AB 1058. So it's called the AB 1058 Joint Subcommittee, and it's comprised of members from the Family and Juvenile Law Advisory Committee, from the Workload Allocation Advisory Committee, and from this committee, the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee. And there are three co-chairs, myself, Judge Heinrichs down the aisle here, and Judge Juhas, and she's from WAC, and Judge Juhas is from TAMJU. And so the three of us are the co-chairs of that subcommittee. And there are also other members of that subcommittee who are on this committee, primarily our co-chairs here. And so I think, have I missed anybody else who's on it? Oh, yes. So there's five of us, and I was looking through the list. We have the three co-chairs. We have Commissioner Alexander, who's retired. We have Judge Alfney, Judge Conklin, and Swami, Mark Beckley from DCSS, Judge Lucas down the aisle here, and Sharon Morton from Fresno County, and who's representing WAC, and Judge Thompson from Nevada County, and representing Andrew and Ms. So those are the members of the committee. The committee started in 2015 with an assignment to recommend a methodology for allocating the funding under AB 1058 for family law facilitators and family law commissioners and the staff that work with them. And we recently kind of restarted with reauthorizations from the Judicial Council. We restarted and subcontracted Ms. Fleming and Judge Conklin to kind of start over with the same process that we went through in reevaluating WAFM to evaluate what are going to be the goals, what are the purposes. And I think we're on a better track now. And we're also on a better track in that we have a new goal to meet more regularly and not let periods of time lapse in between when those have lost momentum. So I don't know that we have a deadline, but I think we're looking to have a recommendation by the I don't remember what we said at the end of the year, was it?
I think that was our goal.
Yeah. And that's really all I can fill you in on. If there anything else you wanted, because Judge Heinrichs is happy to
Yeah, I'll let Judge Heinrich speak as well. It is an active, hardworking committee. We did, Judge Cope said restart. I mean, the committee was, all the members were struggling through this for good reason. It's a very sophisticated issue, funding methodology issue. And I want to thank Rebecca, being Ms. Fleming, for being in the room, because she's kind of been the magic behind the movement, at least so far. So we have our meeting scheduled in April, and Rebecca's trying to convince us to have a two-day meeting in May or June to keep the momentum going. Judge Heinrichs, you have any thoughts?
Well, what makes it more complex is it's not just funding the commissioner piece, the courtroom piece of it, which is one thing, but it's the family law facilitators and how that might impact small courts differently than larger courts and still get the allocations to be fair. It's sort of all the same issues we've talked about here and struggled with in the funding methodology subcommittee, but it's sort of bigger in both directions. And so I think the challenge really for the subcommittee is getting a recommendation out that won't, when it gets to the council, basically be attacked on all sides. And so I think that's really trying to get the people in the room to say there may be, you know, more about it, but these are the compromises that we recommend for this piece. And it is a real challenge based on those types of things. So I think earlier we were working on a recommendation that we could have gotten through with, but I think it would have been one that would have been attacked kind of on all sides and wouldn't have been of value to the council as a whole. So I think stepping back and doing the work we're doing now, even though it's, you know, for those on the funding methodology committee, you know, it's hard work and compromise and things is what's necessary to make something that's going to be of value. So the subcommittee recognized that and took a step back to do this, and it's, again, it will be a lot of hard work to get to a place where hopefully the subcommittee comes up with something that one, the three committees that they come from agree with, and then can go to the council in a way that will be the recommendation, hopefully, because, you know, we do know from a standpoint if all the small courts send a letter saying this doesn't address us at all, it's unfair, or the larger courts say that there's some unfairness with it, then the council doesn't have any real way to move. So we recognize that, and I think we're all working really hard, which is a good thing.
Rebecca?
So I think Judge Heinrichs brings up a really important piece in that, by the time we get to the council with the recommendation, there's been a lot of work done, and we have been, I know I've been driving some people crazy because I keep saying come to the meetings or look at this information, it's going to affect you, but it really is important that if you have something to say, you need to say it now, because they're doing the work now, and there's a lot of work being done, and you know, if you can't attend the meetings, review the materials, send in public comment. The more review that's done, the less surprise there is at the end of the day. Nobody is attempting to surprise anybody, and so it's really unfair, quite frankly, to the group if we're not going to look at the work that's being done and then at the end of the day criticize what's been done if we're not going to give them input. And so, you know, I would really encourage everybody to at least review materials, send in comments, call in if you can't attend, but Judge Heinrichs is right. It's, by the time we get to the council, you know, you should have heard some of the information, and it very likely is going to change the way that money is allocated. And so please participate to the extent that you can.
So I think I'm probably going to mirror the same comments, except to say that if you consider what we went through with the new funding methodology, the revised funding, and how we came to that ultimate decision, and I think the reason that, and I don't mean to speak for everybody, but at the kickback meeting, I think the reason it ultimately was approved and moved on was because of the recognition that all perspectives were considered and vetted thoroughly, and there was significant and valuable compromise in the room. Judge Cope's an example of that. You all saw that happen, at least those on FMS, about how we move forward. So not only do we encourage all comments, we consider them, and it involves compromise, and that's what I think has now created momentum as far as we've moved through this, because there's different parties that are involved in this compromise than there were in FMS, so in the funding methodology. So anyways, I'm encouraged and optimistic that we can bring a recommendation, that joint subcommittee can bring a recommendation forward. Yes?
I remember when this came up a couple of years ago that DCFS was also involved in reevaluating the way they distribute assets and provide services, and it was going to be a two-year look or something like that. Have they completed that? Do we know what they're doing on their side?
There's been changes at DCFS, including from the director. So to answer your question, and Judge Heinrichs might have a different perspective, I don't know if no is too strong a word to say they haven't completed, but
I don't think they got all the work done that was anticipated. Ms. Griffith, who was the spearhead of all that, is not the director at this time, and so they're doing the work they need to do to shore up what they need. But there was there is still a recognition, I think, at the Department of Child Support Services that they need to look at how they're doing their work, and it does impact the court. And that's part of, we're still having that discussion, and there's still Department of Child Support Services in the room when we're having our discussion. So I think that's still a valuable piece.
It is, and I didn't mean to imply that DCSS has not been involved or is for some reason not come up to task because of the change. They had a member at the last meeting, and that he was there and very active, so they are participating. It's just given that change in the current.
I think there was concern that somehow they were leading us as opposed to being partners at the table, and I think that it's very much listening to each other's discussions, but they're not. Part of the problem is when we start talking about funding and are the numbers right and how do we count the numbers, which is something that we're dealing with, and there's sort of agreement that that's a hard number to capture accurately. So having them at the table to have their numbers, because they have a set of them as well, is important for us to be hearing from.
I do think, though, to the extent that they were not complete with their information, I think that we got more of an emphasis of being partners rather and coordinating our efforts rather than one leading the other. And many of the things that we had discussions on, at least from the body language, they were, I think, pleased with the conversation and the way it was going. And so we didn't take any motions, but at the same time, I think that it's headed down that path, and they don't seem to be there wasn't any negativity coming from them.
Mike?
Yeah, on that point, one of the courts, I don't know if everybody did or there's a select group, but we got involved in the time study and the report. I don't think we've seen anything back.
No, they haven't.
From that report. Is there anything there? Have you seen anything?
No.
I'm sure we spent a lot of time, put a lot of time into that.
Was that the contractor?
Yeah.
There is a PowerPoint that he prepared, but I don't know that it got into the detail of, like, the results of your time.
They declined to share the data behind it.
Oh, okay.
I think the methodology was flawed anyway.
I'm happy to share the PowerPoint.
Yeah, that'd be great. I mean, we've just been sitting around in and out, then
we were part of it, too. And
I get asked a question about it. It was a mess.
I'm not sure we want to use the data.
Excuse me. It was complicated.
I think you appreciate the struggles. Anything else on that general discussion item? Judge Cole, thanks so much for that update on it. So now we're going to move to the second item, which is the budget update, and Zlatko is here for that.
Thank you, and I also have John Wardlaw here.
Yep.
Anything I'm missing, we're happy to chime in and support the information that we're about to provide. So, yeah, we're in the middle of our sort of budget season with the legislature. A hearing coming up on Monday. But I want to sort of track back to where we started. So, you know, the budget came out in January. There was an LAO review. We had some meetings with LEG staff as pre-hearings. We've been warmly and received as far as the budget proposals that they are, as far as the amounts, and there's some reaction is that it's, you know, good to see the investment by the administration in the branch. We've been supported by Kim Fenner, Sherry Carter, Jake at what are called pre-hearings. They're a more informal meeting of legislative staff with departments, and us with us at the council there, and having the trial court support the meetings. Those have been very good. Also include the Department of Finance and typically the legislative analyst. There was a meeting in middle January that was with the Senate that did not include the legislative analyst at that time. Subsequent to that meeting, the legislative analyst's report came out in which they didn't recommend any reductions to any of the amounts that were proposed in the budget, but they did have some commentary. And generally speaking, they tend to remind and want to remind the legislature of their constitutional authority to appropriate, and therefore appropriate based on legislative priorities. So that was no surprise to us when we saw those recommendations, in particular as it relates to the $75 million discretionary funding that was proposed by the administration.
but we, in our pre-hearings and our hearing and our pre-hearings that we've had, just had one last week in the assembly, we said that the there. Again, we pointed out how critical it is that this fund be discretionary for the trial courts, given the historical budget reductions and each court taking them in different ways, that the courts are in different places. And so we did a great job with the Sherry's support for in the pre-hearing and explaining why that's important. So that's sort of an important focus of the budget discussions, is that $75 million issue. And we coming up, we have an April 9th hearing in which Judge Buckley will be there representing the branch with us. And we expect Martin Shinna will also be there in terms of presenting the overall branch needs. And we'll be there as staff to support the branch's budget request. And what's good this year is that the branch's budget request is what is the proposal by the administration. And so they'll be providing support for those proposals, whereas years past, when we had our priorities and they weren't included in the budget, it was us alone representing the needs of the branch. But I think it's a really good place where we're at in terms of maintaining that support for the budget. What we've been hearing, sort of the fuzz from the Capitol and from court visits, is that there's a lot of support for the budget, and I'm sure some of you who have had your own visits are hearing the same and reporting to us, which is good, so that we're all staying on the same page as far as issue spotting and preparation for the upcoming hearing. So, again, the budget's been a positive one from the sort of legislative budget process thus far. I don't know if John has anything, or the folks who have been party to the meetings thus far want to provide any of their inputs and observations. Feel free.
I think you did a good job, Z, in characterizing the current tone at the Capitol.
Yes.
Assembly Member Stone is the only voice that I've heard so far that's questioning the discretionary use of the $75 million. He's asking whether or not it should be repurposed for some child-related issues. But that's it. That's the only member that I've heard outwardly expressing that. For the most part, all other voices have been saying, it's about time to see discretionary funding in the governor's proposed budget, and it's very important.
He did reiterate that, John, in a meeting with our presiding judge and CEO last month, he told them that he would like more legislative oversight over the money. I think we're going to continue to have meetings with them. I'll bring this back to our executive committee because, obviously, he's our representative. He's from Santa Cruz, but I think we will try to have some meetings with him if he will talk to us and explain to him how the $75 million, the $47.8 million really benefits those issues that he appears to be concerned about.
Thank you, Judge.
Kim, you were putting your hand up. Yeah, but John, I was
going to
ask John to cover that piece, but he did. Thank you.
So, I think it was good that Sherry described to me that the tone of the meetings and interactions were positive and cordial, as opposed to adversarial and contentious.
Which is what I expected.
Yeah, and that's not always the case, but in this case, I think this is, again, it just speaks to the positive work, and I think it speaks to us as a branch staying on message with the proposal in the governor's budget, that the members and therefore their staff are not hearing differing messages, and therefore when we say we are supporting the governor's budget, there isn't a concern, but what about this or what about that? That's you know, the legislature may do that, but we as a collective branch have been done, I think, a great job of really staying on point and focusing. And while there are many needs beyond what was proposed in the budget, everything in its own time, and the time is now for what is in the budget, and we continue to support that. And to the extent that you have any more, just as Judge Maragon to describe, any more visits, we're always encouraging you to feedback to us, you know, what you're hearing, so we can ensure that, you know, we're well aware of what might be some of the messaging going on out there. So separate apart from what we're doing.
I think it's important to note, though, it would have been a more adversarial tone in the assembly pre-hearing had the recommendations of the LAO with respect to tying down the discretionary funding, had that gotten or appeared to have gotten more traction, we would have been much more proactive in pushing. It didn't get the traction. And so we let that one go. We were on record strongly that we support the discretionary nature of the funding, that it's absolutely necessary. That point was really well delivered, I think. And there appeared to be no support for going a different direction, just so you know.
Maybe this is a related question or more a Corey question, but are there other kind of legislative initiatives that you're tracking that that might come up
in terms of budget?
No.
That will come through the budget process, though?
Or they're kind of potentially going to have impacts on us next year, whether it's budget or operational. New demands, new mandates, those kinds of things. Extension of amnesty. No, but are there any particular, because I've got. Yeah, a fraction of the calls I've gotten in past legislative sessions for feedback and input. So, a
few things that immediately come to mind is there's the amnesty program. There's a proposal to extend it that has got us saying, wait, time out. That's significant fiscal impact to us. The Department of Finance is also tracking it. So that's one that's on the radar.
And that's 6 years.
Right. So, and it's big. So that's got our attention. Irrespective of the policy call, there are budgetary implications that people need to understand. And so pushing that button pretty hard. The other one is with respect to bail reform. There's a lot of conversation going on in the building. Obviously, that has huge fiscal implications to us. I'm not hearing or seeing anybody looking to this governor's budget to address that issue, but there's conversation going on.
So in terms of where we are, so the first update to the budget occurred, technically it was statutorily it's due on April 1st, and that's what would come of our spring BCPs, would result in what's called a spring finance letter, an actual letter by the Department of Finance to the legislature requesting that the budget bills be amended for the changes of funding that are that they're pursuing. And so there were a number of BCPs that we submitted for the spring consideration this last year. They were generally related to IT, and they were there was one that was approved that included and forwarded to the legislature and will be briefly discussed on Monday's hearing regarding self-represented litigants in a web portal and some e-services for that. And Department of Finance saw that as a complement to the $19.1 million that was included in the governor's budget. There were three other items that were IT-related as it relates to the sort of third phase of our updating of our case management systems that were, as there was an issue of upgrading and improving our Phoenix financial systems and also scanning of our historical records and even current records. Those three were deferred to fall. They were not denied based on merit and did not see the need, but rather asked that there be more time spent exploring those issues and debating those. And so while we prefer to have the money, we appreciate that they didn't say that there's need that is not there, but rather an additional discussion. The next update that will occur will be at the May revision, May 14th. That's also a statutory date on or before May 14th. The budget needs to be updated based on revenues, based on caseload, enrollment, population, all of those things. And the governor has to rebalance the budget based on those sort of core drivers of cost. So again, that will be on May 14th. And that's really when sort of the fire gets hot. Because now the legislature knows where the revenues are, they know where the governor sort of refined the proposal, and the hearings will really start taking shape as far as actions and closing down and setting up what's the legislative budget priorities versus the
the governor's budget priorities. What I will say is that since the budget was proposed in January, and we're only a few months past that, that revenues are about 3.5% higher, almost $2.5 billion than what was anticipated. So we're not talking back to the June budget, but just the recent update that was proposed in January. So, and there, the folks at the Department of Finance believe that that's a reaction to the federal tax change. Some large deposits, some readjustment, but that's far better position than it could be if it were we're heading in the wrong direction. You know, we've seen volatility in the markets, but they're California unemployment is at an all-time low since they've been measuring it back in the 70s. So understand that the labor market's strong, and therefore there's going to be personal income tax paid, and so that's good. A couple of issues that are still that I wanted to address that I know we'll kind of get to in the next, and maybe this is the time to transition, unless there's questions generally about the budget.
Hey, Nate, can I just jump in real quick? Those who are tracking the April 9th hearing and the 19th hearing, they will not be taking action with respect to the bigger items in our budget. So don't be surprised if they keep these issues open. That's not to be – no alarm should be going off. Very typical on big budget items when we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars. They will wait until the May revise when they know what their revenue picture is looking like before they take action. So don't misconstrue the leaving it open as time out, we've got a problem. We don't. It's a normal course of May revise comes out, updated revenue projections, and then they will take off a large number of actions on the consent item and move things. So if you're watching, don't be surprised if they keep things open.
Yeah. Good point.
David?
Yeah, there was a question. One of the points that you made related to revenue and the direction. For this budget year, we did not have success with backfilling. And I think there was a sense that there was openness to discuss the
I'm going to talk about that when we get to the PCTF issue.
And Amazon? Yeah. Okay, great.
Well, and deal hold issues and all of that, Jack.
Sir, Marcus, did you have a comment?
I did, yeah. There was a question earlier by Mike Platt about legislation making its way through the process that would have an impact on the courts. I wanted to mention a couple of bills. One by Assemblymember Ting would require courts set aside all convictions, all cases where probation was successfully completed, and enter pleas of not guilty. Currently, the law allows people to petition, defendants to petition for that relief. This would actually put the burden on the courts to do all that. That's for relief that could have been sought since 1970. Yeah, Mike, I got another one, but go ahead.
Well, on that, I got a sidebar update from Corey yesterday, that they've successfully, they believed in print, but that the authors agreed that first of all, they wouldn't go back to 1970, and that it would be, the onus would be on probation to identify the cases that they would then bring to the court in order for that activity to occur. So while it's still a real onerous task, there, at least it seems like we're making some movement to take it off the back of the court and to go back to 1970. So they're actively working that measure, but I think it's really good that you put that out there for others to be aware of.
Thank you. And actually, what happens when you have informal grants of probation, which is the majority, and the others are still on the court?
Right.
Okay, so that could be a problem. And the other one is a bill by Assemblymember Rubio that would require that there be court reporters taking down all testimony in child custody and hearings and hearings under the Domestic Violence Prevention Act. So in San Diego,
I want to update on that one.
San Diego lost, I understand, 10 reporters last month who retired, and so this will put a great deal of strain on courts. We don't have enough reporters now.
And we can't hire 10 new ones without going into the inexperienced pool of reporters. So,
all right. So you want to roll right into the next?
Item
three.
Transition is, so you know that at some point there will be a
allocation requests that we have to take to the council, and one of them relates to IMF. And, you know, that we did submit a budget change proposal that would look to help shift some of the costs out of the IMF to the general fund. That issue is still in process, and so it is influencing sort of the timeline that we have as far as coming to you and ultimately to the council to make the improvement and modernization fund allocation recommendations. So that's still going. That's an important issue in terms of solvency and maintaining the critical programs that are funded out of the IMF. Now we can get to the TTTF. So you do have the TTTF fund condition, and while the very bottom line has some negatives in terms of some structural issues, line 47 I think is heartening for me in that it's positive and it's not in the single digits of money, which it has been in the last half.
It's at page 37 of your material, by the way.
The very last page of the material. While there was a positive fund balance, given our set asides for things like interpreter funds, court appointed counsel, and whatnot, there were actually net negative unrestricted fund balance. So we're as revenues have slightly improved, and then there's just been under expenditures, as we talk about, for example, in judicial comp, there's been vacancies there. So we have a sort of accumulation of little amounts of money that end up adding up to quite a bit. So that's good. So that's sort of the position we're in, but it is still tenuous in terms of where the revenues are and what that might mean in terms of future fund management for the TCTF. We don't have room to go expanding and creating new programs, but we have some level of fund balance. And why that's important is this, as David has raised, is that this time last year, we were all working feverishly to convince the Department of Finance that the proposal that was included in the 17-18 governor's budget related to eliminating the driver's license holds would have a fiscal impact on our revenues. And we, at the time that the governor's budget had been proposed, had estimated a $55 million backfill need. But that was in the absence of information regarding that proposal. And January 10, when the budget came out, the budget director of the Department of Finance said there'd be no impact. Well, we had to overcome that, and many courts joined together with us to explain, and they had some experience about what the driver's license hold was going to mean as far as lost revenues to the branch, notwithstanding the policy, but rather what does it mean as far as our funds. So ultimately, there was an acknowledgement stated by the Department of Finance that there would be a review of the revenues that would be impacted. We not only told them about the base allocation revenues that would be impacted, but also the other revenues that flow in that are related to, you know, that we benefit from traffic and its collection, the IMF, the SCFCF, the two construction funds, and also, and I think for those courts that participated in this, the visits with the Department of Finance over the summer, you also explained that there was civil assessments that were retained by the courts were also going to be impacted. So we gave them the full picture of what was going on. Well, in terms of sort of where the budget proposal came, that they fully funded the 18-19 estimated shortfall that we calculated back in November of $34 million additional to the 55. So the budget reflects that full cost as far as the base allocation revenues. Nothing as far as your civil assessment losses. And the IMF issue kind of gets wrapped up in looking at its solvency. So that's still in discussion, but nothing in terms of the SCFCF and the ICNA, except that we now have this budget proposal that restarts our construction program. So in a way, they dealt with it for 10 projects by acknowledging that there's no revenues there in the ICNA, and they proposed general fund paying least revenue. So then we've kind of gotten a number of our areas dealt with or are still in process. But what was left is, in the current year, we had, at the time that we created the estimate, we were seeing about a $25 million shortfall in the current year against your base allocations. So 55 growing by 25 million. They said, you know, appreciate the information. Let's keep looking at it. And so that has happened, and revenues have improved in terms of their civil. They're still down on the criminal side, but civil has had a bit of a turnaround, and so that gap, while a gap is still exists, it's not as big as it used to be, and it's in the $6 to $7 million range. We asked, so where are we at in terms of that issue as far as covering that shortfall? And there's an awareness of our fund balance in the TCTF, and so their position is that they're not going to do anything as it relates to the current year shortfall. That is for the branch to deal with. And so I'm bringing it to you as an information item that we will eventually need to then take as an action item, I believe. We can talk about the process for there. But there's basically two options. One is that an allocation be reduced to each court, or we look at the TCPF fund balance to bridge the gap. And I would say that at this late date in the fiscal year, that the unwelcome news of the lack of backfill would not be well received, and thankfully we do have an option to use the TCTF revenues and the fund balance, that would be where we would go. So that would be our staff recommendation, but we think it's still the opportunity of this body, and I think the FMS, to look at any shortfalls that you deliberate as you're obligated to. We think that that should be something we should bring forward to you for your consideration at a later date. But we have a recommendation. We would make a staff to not harm the court in the current year. And understand that the $34 million will have changed, that it's still in the budget. And, as far as revenue updates, that the Department of Finance has looked to us to see if that revenue number has changed. But understand that given the action in this current year, our estimates, we would look to be appropriately conservative ensure a sort of minimal volatility in the out year.
Sherry?
So I think that referral would be not to the funding methodology, but to the Revenue and Expenditure Committee, because they're the ones that draft. And I think we need to do that sooner than later, because it's not on the agenda as an action item, but I think that we would support the staff recommendation to have it come out of the fund balance. But if it needs to go through that process, I think that needs to happen sooner than later.
Yeah. And I know we've talked about whether it's FMS or R&E. And FMS is talked about.
It's definitely R&E, because we look at the, right? When you
agree. I agree.
But allocate.
Sorry.
Shoot. Yeah, funding methodology really has to be Yeah.
We talked about whether there's revenue allocation, like when you did the 22.7 shortfall a few years ago. I believe that was more debated.
Yeah, that's probably right, because we didn't have a fund balance, right?
Right. And
so we had to talk about how to allocate it.
We offset it against the gain that was in that particular year, the 86 million dollars.
Well, whichever committee,
yes.
I'd say sooner than later.
Indeed.
Right. Yeah, I think the purpose of this is to make sure we all know it's coming.
Yeah.
An update
yeah.
of information that will filter its way up through us from
yep.
one of them.
Yep.
But I say you've been warned, I think, is the good way to we've been warned.
Yeah.
Yeah. Any other thoughts on any, on that update? Okay, Blanco.
Does that address your questions?
Yes, thank you very much.
Great.
Okay, so that gets us to lunches here, but I think it'd be most advantageous to probably move to a general discussion first. I've had a discussion with some of you at the break, and I know many of you are trying to make early travel arrangements, and I don't want to prevent that by saying, okay, let's have lunch and then come back for general discussion. On the other hand, I don't want to short-circuit general discussion. If there's anything of significance as we get into it, we'll take the time we need. So unless somebody's particularly hungry. Kim, did you have a comment?
Are
you hungry? Anything significant?
I had heard from one of the CEOs with regard to the article on the federal jury increase that hadn't happened in 30 years, and they finally got an increase, and so they were just wondering about state juror increases and how would we go about something like that. But so it had gone into SWATCO. We talked about it a little bit yesterday. Not even sure what committee would propose that. Obviously, a DCP would be the avenue to approach, and since we're in the middle of those now for 1920, maybe this is something down the road. But how would we get something like that before this committee?
To a consideration of a recommendation for increasing jury fees?
That,
David?
It strikes me as something that has to go through a legislative process.
I mean, a budget change proposal can be accompanied by trailer bill language to make the necessary statutory changes. For example, the pilot program for the traffic adjudication has accompanied trailer bills to facilitate its implementation. So that's not unheard of that you can have
fiscal.
I mean, in fact, that often happens.
Right.
That you change the law to spend or not spend the money that's in the budget.
It seems to me there may be a couple possibilities. First would be that it would filter up through this group as something on our list of BCPs. It's also, I think, conceivable in the Judicial Branch Budget Committee, chaired by Judge Rubin at the Council, could make that a branch-wide BCP of their, you know, initiation, and then they would add that to the list that we provide, the appellate courts provide. So that obviously would be, and I think if I go back to the last increase we had, it was something that was built in as a BCP and then agreed to and added legislatively. So
would it be, I'm not sure if it's a cart before the horse kind of thing, because if the fees, we can't, how do we put in a BCP for something that doesn't exist yet? So
you propose that.
So legislative that, increase
the
jury
cost.
Fees and then fund it?
Yeah, say effective July 1st with the enactment of the budget, that the fees go from X to Y and the law is enacted. Because when the governor signs the budget on June 27th, also signing all the statutory changes that go along to make that effective. Like the driver's license hold was signed on June 27th. So that's how they work, is that the budget assumes that this law is changed and the money is either in the budget to cover it, or if something is to stop something from happening, the money is out of the budget.
So how would we go about justifying that BCP? I mean, what kind of work would need to be done to show, for instance, what the federal jury pay is or throughout the nation,
well,
what average jury?
Typically when you merge staff with.
Right.
but you come up with the idea, you have your debate about the merits, and then and that's what we do.
Just remember historically, too, we've had more money in our allocations for jury, which we have cut.
Yes.
So it's one thing to change the fee, it's another thing to answer the question. Had additional funding for jury, which you yourself reduced as cost-saving measures so that there would not be base allocation reductions.
Yeah, those are justifiable. Those are justifiable, but those are also at the rate and usage that are occurring.
Right.
And I think that the question would be, is there a reason that there's savings? Is it because the rate is too low to compel folks to comply with their requirement that they participate in as a juror?
That's one. That you're going to have more of the public interested in and supportive of because it affects everyone versus something that they don't understand with the court specific.
Sure.
I'm not pushing for it, and I'm certainly not the one who's going to request the BCP, but I just wanted to understand what that process would be. And if it does need to be a discussion had with JBCC, I can do that too. I am on it.
And I would just say that there are a lot of issues already before the JBBC, and the discussion has been to what extent can things be pared down and focused for this new administration, and not that I'm saying you shouldn't, but understand that the more expansive you get in terms of your priorities, the more diluted each of the priorities are.
Currently, for 1920, that's why I would suggest that we start a process, but maybe looking toward the 2021.
So a legitimate concern, but maybe recognizing priorities that we defer it a little bit.
They didn't want it to be something that we're just circumventing kickback and going straight to JBBC when typically our BCP is
okay. Judge Cope?
Not to be disagreeable, but I really don't think that's a budget committee issue. I think it should start from the appropriate substantive committee. Presiding judge advisory committee or somebody else. Well, if you're talking about raising jury fees, then I don't disagree. But if you're talking about raising jury pay, I don't think that's really a budget issue so much as a substantive issue that should start somewhere else.
It is jury pay.
And I think that shouldn't be for
last week.
Okay.
David?
I'm just gonna support that. I mean, I think the whole idea of, you know, I'm addressing relates somewhat to yield. Are we able to meet our need for people declining? Because that amount that they receive is just too shy. So that's why I was looking at it from a policy perspective. This is an area that perhaps should be more carefully evaluated because we're just not able to hear the cases. We just don't have enough jurors. That's kind of the angle that I was putting on the table.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's very valid. The flavor I get in the room is how do you get it started and where's the best group to start it, and I'm not sure TICBAC is. It's not strictly, at least right now, a budget item. Though it's very important, obviously, I think we all would recognize the value of jurors, and I do jury trials all the time, and I had a juror yesterday who called and said, I'm just not coming back. I want to be careful, but the jury fees, I'm sure, are not an incentive for jurors to come back. So, and I've got a federal court that I look out my window and I see the federal court down the street, and those jurors, they don't have trouble getting jurors. I think it's something very legitimate. I just don't know if it comes from TICBAC.
My recollection is, too, that there's substantive differences between federal jury service and state jury. We have 1 day, one trial.
There's 2 weeks. Usually they're a month.
30 days, I thought.
And they pay travel, and they pay hotels, and they pay for Starbucks, and they pay for...
Right, the jury is just under the 60 miles to downtown L.A. that would qualify them for the hotel room.
And they got grand jury fees they talk about, so there's some differences. But yeah. I think John's comment too about bail is I think that train is coming and it's gonna be a long slog. I was talking to John at the break about the potential of there's, you know, sometimes from judges we always come from the sky is falling, but if there is appropriate reform approved through the legislature, so to speak, where there's not the impact of the courts appreciated, we could really be in trouble because the judge is going to be called upon to hold hearings in, you know, consistent with arraignments or anything like that. It's going to take what is a 30-second hearing to a 5-minute hearing, and while that might not seem a lot if you multiply by 100 hearings a day, it's a lot of work, a lot of staff, and a lot of money. So,
and the other side of that is managing the program.
Right.
If that happened, who's responsible for that? All that's involved, you know, it's just the administrative component could be just as kind of overwhelming as the judicial component.
Yeah,
I'm concerned that they're not going to fund it properly to begin with. And it's going to force many of us in the position of saying to the judges, if you want courtroom clerks, court reporters, or pretrial services, supervised visitation officers.
Exactly.
And I can tell you where that battle's going to go.
Yep.
Because the judges are, and I think the point was made during the PJ meeting, the judges are going to be very sensitive about releasing people unless they have appropriate and adequate supervision. And that's an unwinnable tension, I think.
It's going to be more than challenging. Any other items of general concern? So my proposal would be, it's now afternoon, that we adjourn for lunch and adjourn the meeting. If any of you have flights to make, would like to get out early, I apologize. We didn't maybe make full use of the 4 hours, but I think we made good use of the 2 hours, so I appreciate all the travel everybody went through. If you want to skip out on the gourmet lunch and get on your way, yes, after we go off the record, I would ask that the FPS members in the room just stay for a second so we can coordinate turning that into a telephonic meeting to make sure we all participate in that. But if there's no other anything else for the good of the order, thank you all very much. And once again, for Go Off the Record, appreciation to staff and all the work that went into preparing for this meeting and that they do every day. Thank you.
The host has left the meeting. So at this time, the meeting will come to an end. Thank you and goodbye.